From 2003 Media, I'm Campbell Barron, and this is The Ones Who Succeed. Welcome to the program. Joseph.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing great, actually.
Are you recording this at the Four Seasons Total Landscaping, or are you in Los Angeles?
I'm in San Francisco right now.
All right.
In my apartment.
Today on the show, I'm thrilled to have a conversation with Joe Albanese. Joe is an entrepreneur based on the West Coast, an entrepreneur that I had the pleasure of meeting this fall. And like many intro meetings, we scheduled a 30-minute time slot, which flew by and turned into a 90-minute call. And by the end of that 90-minute discussion, 90 minutes of content that quite literally could have been a podcast on its own, I knew I had to have Joe on the program to discuss his startup, Stir. So what is Stir? Well, Joe co-founded Stir in the fall of 2019 with the goal of building tools to help creators run their businesses more efficiently. Stir launched their core product this fall, which is a platform that integrates various creator revenue streams seamlessly, presenting it all in one place. However, Stir the company is perhaps more well known for their quote-unquote drops, which for those not familiar are essentially one-off projects in pursuit of Stir's mission, enabling creators to run great businesses, own their content, and build a direct relationship with their audience. For example, OnlyTweets, a way to seamlessly monetize your Twitter feed via a subscription mechanism. Or how about FYP.RIP, an easy way to download all your TikToks, which was in high demand during the potential Trump TikTok ban hype cycle. Nevertheless, it's become pretty clear to me that Stir is a strong company with a great team, a great product, and great investors. The company has raised $4 million in seed funding backed by notable investors including YouTube luminaries Casey Neistat and Mythical, Patreon CEO Jack Conti, Anchor co-founder Mike Magnano, Blake Robbins at Ludlow Ventures, YouTube co-founder Chad Hurley, and of course VCs like Hunter Walk at Homebrew, to name a few. And anyone who knows me knows the intersection of creators and businesses fascinates me. As a result, Joe, based in San Francisco, joined this program via Zoom to discuss his entry point into the world of tech, the origin story of Stir, and of course, why the creators as businesses wave is here to stay. This is The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. My conversation with Joe Albanese starts now. Well, Joe, I really appreciate your time.
I'm happy to be here. We scheduled this like a month and a half ago.
So I'm really excited to talk to you about what you're doing with Stir and all your success thus far. But before we get into that, if you can introduce yourself, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Joe Albanese. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Stir. Stir is a platform for creators that helps them run great businesses. We basically take the role of CFO, COO, and some of the CEO responsibilities off their plate so that they can focus on creating content by themselves and with others.
Now, if you Google Stir or you do any research into who you are as an entrepreneur or as a founder, your experience at this company called Facebook pops up almost everywhere. And it's interesting because you were at Facebook for a very pivotal period of time. And it also seems like your experience at Facebook very much contributed to your success with Stir. So walk me through your time at Facebook. How long were you there for? And what were some of your key learnings?
Wow, great question. So I joined Facebook in 2015, a year before the 2016 election. So I think at the time, as someone that was like in tech, I think the narrative around Facebook was changing a little bit, but it hadn't really hit the like boiling point, I think, of like post 2016 election. And the reason I wanted to go was like, for me, I didn't graduate from college. And for me, it felt like going to Facebook was like college, like a college education around. And I felt like I would professionalize in a lot of ways, learn a lot of soft skills, and like be around a real like product and design team. And those mm-hmm. things were really important to me. One thing that you don't understand until you're in Facebook is just how well it runs internally. It runs really, really well. Like the company is very much product driven, and a meritocracy as well, right? Like good ideas do mm-hmm. get rewarded, and they come from anywhere. I've seen hackathon projects become like full teams around them, which is like really encouraging for a big company. And it still operated like that. That was definitely like the beginning of my time there. And most of it did sort of change post 2016 election. And I think there's like roles and responsibilities of the company. Like when I first joined, it was like being on the friend sharing team, which is like how you create content and share it with folks. was like incredible. And then it changed, right? Because it was like, how do we prevent people from sharing particular articles or consuming particular content? But it was a great time. I'm really grateful for my time there. If I had to say my key learnings, I'd say the first is understanding just being totally product driven is incredibly important for any business. Product should drive everything. It really does at Facebook, I'd say. Two is how to sell. For sure. So like when I got there, I was pretty nervous. Like when I would have to pitch to an executive, mm-hmm. I worked on Messenger for 2 years and mm-hmm. I reported to David Marcus. David Marcus was the former CEO of PayPal. Like I remember being super nervous when I'd go into the room when we would like give a demo of what we built. And then I think after a few reps, you start to realize that it's really not that scary at all. He's just kind of a normal dude. I also had a bunch of opportunities to pitch to Zuck as well. So
and did you?
Those reps. So that was yeah, a bunch of times. Yeah.
And well, okay. Well, I know I kind of hijacked this, but like that's a story of its own.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've worked on projects that were really close to Mark. Yeah, a couple of them. Yeah.
Interesting. I wouldn't have thought that a kind of an employee who joins in 2015 would even have any access to kind of the CEO at just such a large scale company. Yeah. I think that's very interesting.
Yeah. So twofold. One is Mark is deeply involved in product at Facebook, more so than people think. Another thing about Mark is like, it's insane how well he knows just like the Facebook ecosystem. Like he'll be able to recall like an A/B test that a random team ran 3 years ago and like what the like results of that test were. So when you're like coming to him with your new idea, chances are some version of it's been like thought of or tried before, and he'll be able to give you that context like in real time. Another thing about Mark that people don't know is he tests every app. Like in existence.
Like every external app?
Yeah, for sure. He tests every social app. Like he's constantly learning about like what tools are in the ecosystem. He's very product driven. And that was a big learning for me at Facebook, was just like how product should drive everything. Sometimes a door opens and you're in the right place at the right time. I can't say exactly what the project was, but I worked on groups, that I can publicly say. And Mark cares a lot about groups.
And he was cool?
He was cool. Yeah, he's great. Yeah. I think his public persona is way different than his private persona or his like, if you're working at Facebook. He's super cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, the reason I asked this was essentially because one of my favorite questions to ask founders who had prior experience at startups in general or companies in this case, I think it's very interesting to kind of compare the potential learnings at a large company like Facebook versus the potential learning at a kind of, you know, sub 50 person company or a 25 person startup. Because at the end of the day, I would assume that they are very different experiences and you're really working on kind of different problems with a different group of people. So it seems like you reflect very fondly of your time at Facebook, but do you think the learning at an early stage company is greater than the learning at a larger company like Facebook?
Yeah, so I had actually joined Facebook from an early stage startup. So I was the third hire at a startup called YikYak. Joined those guys when they were really, it was just a couple of them and really just getting started. They had just gotten their first office. And that company went on to raise $72.5 million in the year and a half that I was there. And the learnings were immense. I actually think it was an incredible founding. I think most folks out of college should go join a startup because you'll be exposed to skills that you didn't realize you needed to learn or you didn't realize you actually liked, right? Because like they'll just be fundamental to the business and the company just needs, a lot of startups just need like, they need all hands on deck, right? And I loved and appreciated that. I am a big believer in ceilings. Like I just felt like I hit my ceiling at that startup. And if I feel uncomfortable, like the ceiling's right here, I need to like move on to the next thing and build on the next skill. And I felt the same thing at Facebook. So I think you can learn more at a startup. A big company will make you more sharper in some ways and also professionalize you, work on your soft skills. Those are incredibly important as well. Mm-hmm. You need both.
Yeah. So you had both experiences then. And so when you finally make it and you're like, okay, I'm going to start a company. And we originally met, you mentioned something which I think about all the time now. And I actually, regret not asking you about it more then, but I think now is the perfect time. So you said something, you're like, not enough founders do research. Essentially, what you told me was you would basically create these landing pages to test these ideas, run like, Facebook ads to push people to these landing pages and then kind of see the response. Walk me through that process, because I think that is like the biggest learning any potential founder could take from this podcast. Coming up on The Ones Who Succeed, my conversation with Joe Albanese continues. We'll be right back after this. Stick with us. Welcome back to The Ones Who Succeed and my conversation with Joe Albanese. He's the co-founder and CEO of Stir. Walk me through that process, because I think that is like the biggest learning any potential founder could take from this podcast.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, research is so important. So I remember, you know, I left my job October 1st last year. Had the general idea for Stir, although it would go to mature and grow a little bit, as ideas do. But I think there's this really important aspect that you should keep forever. And maybe I learned it from Zuck, which was like, you should be a student of your ecosystem. And students learn, right? You should constantly be learning. And I think like there is this bias towards action for building, which we definitely have. And I encourage folks to always be building, but you have to actually like have a very, very deep level of understanding before you can just go build, because you don't want to waste time building the wrong thing. So I actually have a Notion doc. I'm happy to share it with you after this. That was like, I'm going to learn these things between now and the end of the year. And there are these like very, you know, high level philosophical questions about the space. And like, then there were like tactical things. And like, I'm going to learn them because I'm going to run like 5 different tests. I'm going to like DM, you know, 250 creators, and I'm going to like talk to, you know, 25 managers or something. And then I did that. And then I spoke to all these people. I ran all these tests. And it's so funny. I, you know, one thing that sort of changed over the last year, and I encourage everyone to push through this as well, bring it up, is no one wanted to get back to me back then. I mean, it's humbling for sure. Like no one would ever text me back. No one would take me seriously. I've had people cancel on me a minute before the meeting and then never follow up with me. And I think that's fine. Like you're a student, you're learning. And just really, I just left that because now it's a little bit different. But you know, the lessons that I learned back then were just like what exactly to build and what were the key core problems that need to be solved. And you build this level of empathy with your, you know, your customer base that is just like unmatched and like will literally be the biggest competitive advantage between you and your customers that stems from the early research phase. So yes, founders should be doing as much research as possible. And like, you got to get good at research and you got to like learn and talk and test and build and iterate. And like good product building is just totally iterative. And you only get that from like learning.
And so when you say research though, like what did this research look like? You said you tested around 5 concepts or whatever. Were these Squarespace landing pages with Facebook ads? Like were these actually functioning products?
Yeah. So it was half and half. Half of it was Webflow landing pages that I built and ran some Facebook ads on top of. The other half was coffee shop meetings and just questions and getting to know folks and asking, hey, can I come to your shoot? Right? Oh, you're shooting some content? Like, would you mind if I joined? Like, oh, you know, we do like creator, our businesses, a lot of creator business tools. Like, oh, you're doing your taxes? Like, can I help? like what do you need help with? Really just being available and being like a friend. I think we've benefited deeply from the fact that a lot of our early customers, I now have personal relationships with because I just cared so deeply about their problems, like literally made their problems my problems. So I think it's twofold, right? There's like the quant and the qual level of like, you know, approaching research. And I did a healthy amount of both. Yeah, we ran a ton of surveys too, like type forms. This was just me, by the way. So at the time, the company was just me for the first 7 months.
And you did this just Facebook ads, just Facebook ads.
Yeah, Facebook, Instagram ads, a lot of Reddit groups too. I highly, subreddits.
Subreddits.
Subreddits are an amazing source of research. Like when we're thinking about building new products, like when a product idea comes to mind, we'll search Reddit first and see and like get like a general gut sense of like, how big is this problem? We've seen that for a couple things. Now, I want to like maybe put a pin on the research thing by saying like, research is not going to like tell you build exactly this, right? It does take time, writing, thoughtfulness, trying this and then it not working and learning, oh, maybe this is what works to like find the right thing. Like we have a Splits and Collectives product. You know, we never read about those in a subreddit, like ever. right? No one asked for those things. But research is just a thread that you're supposed to pull on, and you find interesting things along the way.
I'm sure you've heard this, right? Many smart founders, angel investors, venture investors will say, solve a problem that you experience, that you personally have. It's easier to solve a problem that impacts you because you know who to solve it for. And STIR is not that. Like, you're not a creator. You seemed like you immersed yourself in this creator world to have empathy for the customers or your potential future customers. But what do you say about that idea?
I disagree with that. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of these sort of blanket statements that I hear all the time. For every blanket statement that you've given, there's like five really successful examples that, like, you know, just sort of poke holes at that. I disagree with that. I think, like, the two things that I say is, like, I mean, I couldn't work for a company that's not mission driven. You need to be uniquely mission driven. And, like, we're relentlessly driven by a mission. Like, I just deeply care about this, like, shift that I believe is happening in the world. And I want to, like, be involved with it as much as possible. That to me is just as strong as, like, if I was a previous creator. Now, will we have some competitive advantages, or maybe, like, yeah, there'd probably be some shortcuts we could have taken if I was a creator. Like, I remember there was, for the longest time, we were trying to test YouTube, and none of us had a YouTube account. So we needed to, like, get really, I think I bought some YouTuber ice cream and they let me have access to their YouTube account. There's so many fun stories.
Now, walk me through the fundraising part. So I have a couple pillars. I promise we're going to get to what STIR is and, like, your product. But this is very interesting because you really seem to stack together this A-list combination of venture investors and angel investors and even some creators. And it's interesting because I've had founders on the program who have really, like, made an emphasis on the fact that they raise money early on as a big pillar in their success. I've also had founders who've bootstrapped their way to, you know, 7-8-figure revenue. And I think, again, both ways seem to work for different situations. But I'm curious, what was your thinking in regards to raising venture money early on?
Yeah, so where I raised a pre-seed in November of last year, so a year ago, when the idea was, you know, basically words on a napkin. And it was $500,000. So it was $500,000 I raised. And for me, it's like, so much that matters in my view, and it's different for everyone, but, like, so much that matters in my view is, like, you need to move fast. Like, execution matters, speed matters. And for better or worse, money allows you to move really, really quickly. Like, early research phase was, like, I was able to get a lot of that together because I was able to, like, go down to LA, live in a community house with me and eight other people, but, like, be in LA, be able to get those meetings. We hosted a manager dinner that, like, I just wouldn't be able to do that stuff out of pocket. But, like, all those managers became our first customers, right? So, like, money allowed us to move really quickly. And I'm a big believer in, like, it allows you to do that. And if you have a really big vision, and not to say, like, people that don't raise money have small visions, I don't mean that at all. But, like, capital is a tool that will allow you to move really, really quickly and you know, basically have more leverage in some of the things that you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And so you got your pre-seed round, and then you ended up raising a seed round from, you know, Hunter Walk and the friend yeah. of friend of show Blake Robbins and Mike Magnano, also another friend of the show. But then you also yeah. stacked on creators like Casey Neistat and the guys at Mythical, Rhett and Link. And so this is very interesting.
And Jack Conte.
And Jack Conte from Patreon, right? And building in, you know, the same space, essentially. And so you also mentioned something when we first met, which was your investors work for you. And that sounds, you know, great. Do you remember saying that?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I still say it. And I would say it to all of them. I don't know if I have said it yet to them, but
okay,
yeah,
well,
they do.
I remember that. And I think of that and research, I thought about a lot after. But that quote is great. But I also think it's probably difficult to hear if you're a founder who's having a very difficult time raising money. Because when you have lots of people who are interested in what you're doing, you have options. And you can yeah. actually vet out the investors that you think would be best suited for this venture, right? It's not yeah. just money, it's smart money. But if you're really having a difficult time raising money, you're kind of just taking, you know, a collective of checks from anyone who's kind of willing to, or, I mean, that could be a mistake, but there are founders who do that. And so how did you essentially go about raising money from this group of A-list individuals, and why do your investors work for you?
Okay, I'll answer the first one. So our situation with fundraising was a little interesting. First of all, I've never met Blake or Hunter Walk or most of our investors in person because I fundraised during COVID. It's all been over Zoom, FaceTime, and phone calls and texts. So, like, our process is just way different than anyone that I think raised before. That's first. Two is, especially at the seed, 100% at the seed, the investor is not investing in your pitch deck or, you know, the mocks or the product you have today. They're investing in you. So it's very much it's a personal relationship first. So I actually focused on that. So the story of how I worked with Homebrew and Hunter is actually a good one. You know, we met for the first time and he had some notes on what we were doing. So there wasn't I didn't need to run through a deck again. He was pretty primed for the conversation. And it was very much like a personal discussion about ourselves and what I was working towards and about my background and what I learned at different companies, kind of similar to the questions you're asking me. And it felt like after that conversation, we wanted to work together, but it wasn't either the timing wasn't right or the relationship just wasn't there. And after I basically pretended that we had already partnered and would send him updates, would send him hey, I'm talking to this guy who actually became my co-founder, what do you think of the things I should work on? Sent him some new mocks, sent him the test flight. And in my mind, the whole time, it was we're going to work together. We'll just go figure it out eventually. And I think at the seed, if I had to give one lesson, it'd be focus on the folks that you can build a personal relationship with, because that is really what matters. Maybe the thing I'm most proud of, though, is our cap table is 30% female. The industry average is 6%. Mm. That's something that we actually pushed the seed round 2 weeks longer than usual to make sure we got that done. Then on the latter question, which was, our investors work for us. Yeah, I mean, I think that really is the case, right? They've made this bet. Investors only make so many bets in a year. So the stakes are high for everyone. And, you know, when you're thinking about who to work with, I always say you want to adopt the mindset of a teammate. Maybe that doesn't mean they work for us, but when I send this person a problem that I have at 10:30 p.m. on a Thursday night, is that problem going to resonate as much for them as it's going to resonate for me? And we only work with people that we think that's the case for. So not so much that they work for me. I do think you should you have to manage those relationships really well, but it should feel like everyone's on the same team.
Mm-hmm. Now, drops. This is how I, first became aware of Stir. It's how, I assume many first became aware of Stir. And essentially, this thesis or this idea behind drops, to fill the listeners in for them not informed, are essentially, mini kind of one-off side projects that the Stir team would, briefly focus on. That would solve, real but kind of bite-sized problems, if you will, very specific problems, but under the Stir umbrella, under the Stir brand. And I would say some of these went viral, some of these, I would assume got you new users for the Stir core product. And I'm sure you've seen this, but I've started to see other startups really start to kind of play this drop game, if you will. And I think that's very interesting. And so walk me through the inception story behind developing these drops, these one-off products, because am I correct in saying that you're actually really investing in drops from a team perspective? Coming up on the podcast, I continue my conversation with Joe Albanese, The Ones Who Succeed. We'll be right back after this. Stick with us. You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed and my conversation with Stir co-founder and CEO Joe Albanese. Welcome back to the program. I'm Campbell Barron. Walk me through the inception story behind developing these drops, these one-off products, because am I correct in saying that you're actually really investing in drops from a team perspective?
Yeah, I mean, we have a drop coming up this month. They sort of change over time, and there's a lot of and I'd say now we're experts on what we think, what we know works and what we know doesn't. The story behind them is quite interesting, though. I wish I could sit here before you, Campbell, and tell you I was this incredibly wise individual that was we're going to build this drops process. But that wasn't the case. It started from a tweet. Microsoft owned a streaming website called Mixer, and it just shut down one day and sold for parts to Facebook. And all the streamers on the platform that were partners, which means they were able to monetize by ads, had just lost a revenue stream. And Mixer basically told them, hey, go to Facebook and apply for partners, or go start from scratch on Twitch. And think about this. These folks have put a year of their life into building an audience on this platform, and the platform goes away, and they have to start all over again. And there was the tweet that I read, and I actually DM'd this Twitter user and told him, thank you for tweeting this, because we built a whole thing around this. But this tweet was these screen caps of the streamers crying on stream. I remember seeing that and I wrote an email up to the team and I was like, keep these people in your mind, these images of people crying as we build, because like if we're successful, or like, first of all, I think good product building is very emotional. It's very emotion driven. And then two is like, you know, if we're successful, like this shouldn't happen, right? So I sent that email to the team and my co-founder, Kashal, was like, we should build something. I was like, what the hell do you want to build? He's like, I don't know. I'm going to go study the API. So he comes back and he comes back with this idea where he's like, we can use the API to pull the list of their followers and the date they subscribe. And I'm like, why would anyone want that? He's like, I don't know, but like, it could be useful. So I'm like, all right, let's just put it together. So we stay up till 3 a.m. and we build it. And then we launch it on the subreddit for Mixer. And I think like 1,200 people use it in the first 24 hours or something. And that was huge, right? Like we just built something that 1,200 people used and found valuable. And it had like this funny tweet. The name of the drop was Goodbye Mixer. And Kashal, my co-founder, made this tweet that said, I'm saying goodbye Mixer and taking my followers with me. I loved it. He like came up with it at 3 a.m. So I think what we learned at that point was like, wow, this space, even though it's been around for, you know, YouTube's been around for 15 years, there's still so many like low hanging fruit, like small one bit size problems that need to be solved for creators. And like, there's a real need for a software team that like genuinely cares about them. And I had known about Mischief's sort of drops playbook and was like, might be interesting if like we sort of adopt that and like we can keep building these one-off things and build an audience around our core business and almost become creators ourselves in a way. But yeah, that's kind of how we came up with it.
And this all led up to the launch of the core product, Stir, this fall. And my first question here is, how's it going?
Oh man, it's going really well. It's so exciting to, you know, we had been working on this the whole time. I don't think folks realize that, like, we had a core business behind the drops the entire time. People thought we were like a product studio. They didn't know what the hell we were. But we had this core business running since May of last year. The thesis that the company is built on is that we're in this shift from institutions to individuals, right? So an institution would say, who can be successful, what success means, like how much they pay them, like what it means to go to the next steps, like a promotion, when you need to work, all of these rules. And that was because an institution sort of controlled reach and distribution. That's no longer the case, right? Like we have all of these platforms that have basically created like a new set of entrepreneurs. And when you look at that set of entrepreneurs, they're just wildly different than a set that's ever existed, right? So, and it spans across all these different verticals, right? So like education, media, advertising, which is sort of like the influencer, news, which is like someone with a Substack. And the things you find about these entrepreneurs is that they have small business needs with consumer expectations, right? So they're very much like passionpreneurs in a sense. Like I'm a Substack writer because I love writing and I have like a very opinionated view on this like particular topic and people are willing to pay for it. So because we have this new world, there was just like a clear answer in my mind. It's like, well, all the tools of the past just are not going to work. So we need to like create new framing, new understanding of how these companies will be built and be like sort of understood. So I look at them as like single player and multiplayer. So I'm going to get a little nerdy for you, but I'll break it down. So single player is like where you start, right? I'm in the single player mode. I like start, I have like my revenue streams and like Stir makes that really easy to understand. Like we make sure you like know how your business is running, like in these glanceable ways. We tell you when the money's coming in and like how much money you have to spend. Those are like the clear single player problems that need to be solved. That being said, where like you get to a point where new growth comes from working with others and working well with others. And you see this on different platforms in different ways, right? YouTube, it's the collab, right? On TikTok, it's the duet. And it happens in all these different ways in all these other platforms. There's tons of collabs too on Instagram and shared stores and merch and all these different things. So we look at that as like a interesting, like these are these micro businesses that are being built together. How can we build tools that allow basically like collab culture to actually go to the next step? And if it does go to the next step, what we believe happens is it almost lowers the barrier to entry for what it means to be a creator. Because like you shouldn't have to like start a YouTube channel and put in like all that investment into like the years that it takes to grow that just to be a creator. Right? You can do creative work without like taking on that sort of early responsibility and work. So that's what Splits and Collectives aims to solve. And we saw them we like the inspiration for those products came from our customers, actually. So I'll tell you like how collectives got started. So it was with the creator, and they were doing a new collab with another creator, and they started a group chat on iMessage. And that was like the formalization of the business. And it was like, I remember sitting there and I was just like, we need to make building a business with other people as easy as starting a group chat on iMessage. Like, that's what we're competing with. It goes back to this SMB customer with consumer expectations. We feel like we compete with the Cash App or Venmo when we move money. So like, how do we make that experience better and like more like, you know, appropriate for these customers? So that's like collectives. And then on splits, we had an accountant come to us, literally cold called me. I don't even pick up cold calls, but I picked up this one. And she was like, I have a problem and I think you can solve it, which is like literally the best.
Oh my God. Yeah.
The best possible thing you were told by the accountant of a creator. And I was like, please tell me what it was. And there was this brand deal that they had that was going to pay them $100,000. And they needed a way to like split the money up between multiple people because no one trusted one person to take all that money. And this is a true story. So I'm on the phone with the accountant. I'm like, oh yeah, we could definitely do that. We have nothing built. We have nothing built. I'm like, oh yeah, like we've been thinking about this. I'm pretty sure we could spin something up and demo for you tomorrow. She's like, really? I'm like, yeah, we'll do it tomorrow. Let's set it up for 4 p.m. tomorrow. So Kashal and I grind on like I do all the designs and spec out what we need and this platform and that. Kashal builds, my co-founder builds the working MVP. We built it in a night and we wound up splitting money, I think, the next week. So that's kind of how we got those pulls and those products. And now they've turned into this like, wow, there's all these different payment systems and like businesses being built. How do you like create more creators and allow more people to participate in the value creation of the creative economy?
So as we wrap up here, one of my favorite topics to talk about with really anyone who listens is, what does the future of media look like? What is like the next generation of media companies look like? And I think about this a lot because you mentioned this. We are seeing this shift from the network to the individual. And so the reason I think Stir's very interesting is because it's really like in the middle of this. You have made a decision to center your company on the side that the individual will be greater than the entity, if that hasn't already happened. So what does the future of media companies, like what do they look like?
Yeah, I mean, I have a very, very opinionated view here because I think it's the entire vision we have for Stir. I think two things need to happen. And then the third point I'll bring up is like what I think we're doing. So the first is we need the US market specifically needs to lean less and less on ad supported content. It is the single biggest blocker right now. And I think we're trending in that direction. Look at Patreon, look at OnlyFans, look at a bunch of the big name creators on YouTube as they're building out these like sort of clubs and stuff. I'm glad we're going that direction. It's just like, if you look at China, right, I think something like 40% of a creator's income is direct from fans. We're at like 10% here in the US, and it's preventing the mid tail of the creative economy to get larger. Two is what I think needs to happen is, and I say this internally to our team all the time, is like, if we're just sitting here waiting for, you know, the big name creator from the New York Times to leave and start a Substack, like we'll just be here forever. Right? It can't be so top heavy. And it needs to be the person that we don't know needs to be able to leave and start their own thing. I always say if we're successful, if Stir is successful, like it won't just be one reporter from the Times leaves, it will be the entire sports section leaves and starts their own sports section on their own. Like that is the level of like vision that I think we have. And then what I think it looks like and what we're trying to do is it is focused on the individual for sure, but it's like the sum of the individuals working together. Right. It's in my view, it's these sort of decentralized, like micro media companies that can work in ways with others and more people can make a living as like a creator in this sort of like media world. I view kind of what we're building as like the platformization of the Barstool model, which is basically like Dave is a creator in a sense. And he like brings other young creative people under him, under the Barstool and his brand and like tries to, you know, blow them up. And then they have their own things and there's these rev splits. So like, I kind of view that as the future. It just needs those tools and that like what they have built as a company needs to be turned into sort of like a platform and allow anyone to do it. And that's kind of what we're trying to do with collectives and splits.
I love that framing. Barstool Sports comes up so many times when people talk about the future of media because it's very interesting what they built. I'm not, you know, necessarily a big consumer of their content. I just really admire, you know, like how it's managed and how they put it together.
The model's fascinating. Yeah, the model's fascinating. And
it's working.
They do really well.
you hear, you know, Vox lays off X people and BuzzFeed lays off X people. And like, you look around you and like the internet media companies, even the internet media companies are like, you know, having a hard time. And then you look at Barstool and they're thriving. And so I think that's a very good indicator that the sky isn't necessarily falling for everyone.
I do view a world where Stir allows for, because it's not just the, you know, you can't, like, the writer on Substack actually has all these other needs, right? They have legal needs, editing needs. They need, like, a graphic designer sometimes to, like, you know, show different things. I actually view our collective since the product applying to how do we bring all these different roles and sort of include them in the network where you can, like, really run a pretty significant and, like, very lean media operation on the platform. And I'm really excited about it because, again, I care so deeply about this space and making the right impact here. And another thing too is I care a lot about how people provide for themselves and their families. That matters to me. That's kind of why I work and for my own family. And the ability to do that for other folks is a big driving force for why we do what we do.
Well, Joseph, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. Great to get to talk to you.
It's always fun talking to you, man. I'm such a huge fan of the podcast. How I found out about the podcast was through TikTok.
Is that crazy?
Yeah, I love it. I'm gonna cringe if I see my face on TikTok. But it's
okay. That's true. Yeah. Oh, you'll see your face. You'll see your face. That's Joe Albanese, one of the ones who succeed. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show, it would be amazing if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. Or why not tell a friend? That also helps new listeners discover the show. I really appreciate it. If you want to see clips from the show and stay up to date with what I'm working on, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Campbell J. Barron. And you can find this podcast on YouTube. Our channel is The Ones Who Succeed. You've made it to the end of the show. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Campbell Barron, and I'll be back in no time.